I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Well, his name and financial support to many causes can be seen all over Central Ohio, but tonight, it's Les Wexner's relationship with the man accused of molesting teenage girls that's still under scrutiny. Jeffrey Epstein is charged with sex trafficking and having sex with girls as young as 14 years old. Epstein was Les Wexner's personal finance manager for more than a decade, but he has denied any knowledge of Epstein's alleged wrongdoing.
That's right. Parallax Views is once again diving into the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein. This time, we'll be looking at the Ohio connection as we scrutinize the close Epstein associate, Les Wexner, the founder of L Brands, whose holdings have included Victoria's Secrets, Abercrombie and Fitch, Express, and Bath and Body Works. Although his close association with Jeffrey Epstein has become a huge embarrassment for the L Brands founder, Les Wexner denies knowing about Jeffrey Epstein's proclivities. That said, Epstein accuser Maria Farmer says Wexner did know. What should be made of the Wexner-Epstein connection? Joining us to answer that question on this edition of Parallax Views is lawyer, political science professor, and maverick, Columbus, Ohio-based journalist, Dr. Robert Bob Fitrakis, who has been covering Wexner and Epstein since the 1990s. Yes, you heard that right. The 1990s. Bob is a dogged reporter who's been covering the darker side of Leslie Wexner for decades, including his ties to the billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. In this conversation, we discuss Wexner's connections to organized crime, Iran-Contra, the selling of the Iraq War, and of course, Jeffrey Epstein, as well as how he may figure in to the 1985 murder of his own tax attorney, Arthur Shapiro. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Bob Fitrakis on the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein, the Les Wexner connection. Welcome to Parallax Views, Bob Fitrakis of the Columbus Free Press, a journalist who has been covering the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein longer than any of us. Bob, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well.
So, Bob, before we get into Jeffrey Epstein, maybe you can give my listeners a little bit of background on your journalism and maybe how you got involved in unraveling the Epstein story, because you've been going at this for what, 30 plus years?
I've got a PhD in political science, and I have a JD as well from Ohio State. When I moved to Columbus from Detroit, I wanted to know where the alternative points of view were. I met with a historian, Manning Marable, who was up at Ohio State, later went on to Columbia. And I asked him, where is the alternative non-corporate point of view? And he said, there's a small newspaper. you ought to join it or take over it. It's very small. And so I went down and volunteered and realized being a professor, and particularly tenure track and tenured, you could get away with writing stuff that nobody else in the private sector would, particularly if it was about a billionaire. So I filled in a gap, a huge gap here in Columbus. That is somebody who might write critically about Les Wexner.
I guess that's a good place to start, because I wanted to ask you, I'm going to have listeners that they know the name Epstein. They know Ghislaine Maxwell now, but they may not know Les Wexner, even though he's an extremely rich billionaire, a former mega donor to the Republican Party. I believe he has said, oh, I don't want to help fund the Republican Party anymore, but involved with Victoria's Secrets. He's a name that we should know, but a lot of people don't. Who is Les Wexner?
Well, even when he was a billionaire early on, he's founder of the Limited, which according to mythology was this small store that he borrowed money on and had a real feel for what fashion directions the women of the country were moving in. And the Limited grew and acquired many things, including buying up a small Victoria's Secrets and it owned Henry Bendel, for example, and really became L Brand. So really the largest kind of retailer of clothes in the U.S., bringing in just, you know, cargo planes full of clothes every day to house American trends.
And so, Bob, do you remember?
What were you going to say?
Go ahead, Bob.
Bob?
Oh, no, that's the mythology. I think there's other things in the Shapiro murder file and other files that indicate it probably wasn't, you know, quite the Horatio Alger story that Mr. Wexner paints it.
Marlon, I know you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I was going to ask Bob. So when did Leslie Wexner, you know, come up in Ohio? Was he always a name in Ohio? Do you remember when you first heard about him? Or what's that story? What years are we talking about?
I first heard about him because I had a roommate, Daniel Sobel, whose family owned a clothing store that burnt down mysteriously in Columbus. And he always told me that it was the people that later hooked up with Les Wexner that probably burnt my grandparents' store down because they refused to do business with him. So I knew about Wexner back in the 80s, but virtually nobody even though he was a billionaire, virtually nobody in Central Ohio knew about him. He was pretty low key. He was very secretive. It was Jeff Epstein who kind of brought Les Wexner out to the public and was kind of, you know, took him to the debutante dance and, you know, convinced him he should be far more public and open. And that really began to happen in the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay. That's interesting, that story of the department store. Was that linked to the Genovese LaRocca crime family in your roommate's mind?
Well, that's what Danny Tobo suggested. He said they, you know, wanted control of the rolling stock, right? The kind of planes that bring in clothes that the Genovese LaRocca crime family wanted into the garment business in the Midwest, particularly in Columbus, because it's famous as a warehouse hub, right? It's conveniently located by virtually all these major cities. It's 3 to 6 hours away, 6 hours to Chicago, 3 hours to Detroit, 3 hours to Pittsburgh, 3 hours to Indianapolis. So Columbus in many ways was always a very handy hub. And if you're, say, moving goods that aren't legal, in a gray market goods that are intended for other markets that are being smuggled or anything else from guns to drugs, what you need is planes and trains and trucks and warehouses. So that's what he thought, is that, you know, that his grandparents didn't want to deal with people who, you know, Wexner was willing to deal with, you know. Again, Tony Salerno, you know, Mr. Walsh of Walsh Trucking, that had reputations as alleged mobsters.
Yeah, so, well, that's great. That sort of connects the two stories I know me and JG wanted to ask you about, which are the Arthur Shapiro case and the Southern SAT case, right?
Well,
so,
we get into that, I wanted to ask, so how does Epstein, this figure who's mainly associated with New York and Florida, how does he end up in the orbit of Ohio's Les Wexner? What's the connection there? How do they come together?
Well, in the mid-80s, Wexner was kind of low-key, living over in a German village in a mansion off Schiller Park, in a thought to be partying, but those were legends, and it was a small group of people that he knew. You know, he was a so-called confirmed bachelor, but he was very secretive, right? He wasn't looking for any publicity. And then in 1985, of course, his key accountant, Arthur Shapiro, working for the limited Mr. Wexner, was killed mob style in a cemetery. And it seemed the man who replaced him as sort of the financial whiz was Jeffrey Epstein, as a guy, insurance mogul named Meister, Mr. Meister, who supposedly introduced him. Les Wexner admits in an open letter, you know, trying to explain everything, that he knew Jeff Epstein since the mid-1980s. But by 1991, Jeffrey Epstein, who virtually nobody's heard of, has full power of attorney, POA, controlling, you know, Wexner's a couple billion dollars. So he filled a void, and some people actually were wondering whether he was involved in the Shapiro murder case. There was no real evidence in that direction, but he sure benefited from the death of Arthur Shapiro. He became the financial whiz kid for Les Wexner.
Now, Marlon, I know that you wanted to ask a question concerning this insurance mogul, right?
Yeah, well, 1985, that was the year that they supposedly met, the same year Arthur Shapiro died. But I was also wondering, this guy, Bob Meister, what more do we know about him? You know, who was he? How did Meister know Epstein and Wexner? And do you remember where you heard this report that they had been introduced?
Oh, that was widely reported in the paper. I mean, Epstein was going through a period, you know, where he was portraying himself. You know, he'd worked for Bear Stearns there a little earlier, but as kind of a bounty hunter with ties to the intelligence community. So he kind of created his own mythology. And he met people, you know, and would charm them. So the notion is, you know, Meister thought he could do some financial things for Mr. Wexner. Again, in 1987, Wexner got hit really hard by the stock market crash. He was overly invested in his own stock, in his own companies, and lacked diversity. Many people argued that was another opening for Jeff Epstein to move in and diversify and move his money literally around the world, and particularly later into the Virgin Islands. So I think Epstein was just this figure who had a certain mythology about him. And again, as Epstein told many people, you know, Les loves me, right? He charmed him, and he did everything. He was, you know, part valet, part fixer. Sarah Cohen, which isn't her real name, who was thought to be the front for Mr. Wexner, the woman he would take to a social event. Again, when it came time to give her a seven-figure check and tell her never contact Mr. Wexner again, people, including Sarah Cohen, report that it was Mr. Epstein who showed up to deliver the check. But hey, if you wanted the troupe of cats, the Broadway touring troupe, to come out to your house and play, Epstein would arrange that as well. So he made himself indispensable to Les Wexner.
Now, in regards to the Shapiro murder file, you mentioned Arthur Shapiro, who worked at the Columbus law firm of Schwartz, Shapiro, Kelm, and Warren. I believe homicide investigators described him as sort of quiet, shy, sort of reserved, even like a loner. But you mentioned he was killed in what was a mob-style hit. I don't know if you can get into that anymore. I don't want to get like sensational with, oh, how did it all happen and all that. But what's the skinny on this murder and the investigation that came after it?
Well, he was in the car with a couple guys. There's different opinions of who those guys were, but they were clearly mob-connected hitmen. I got to look at the file that was in the possession of the Franklin County Sheriff, Earl Smith. He took many of these files with him when he lost the election in 1992, and I used to have lunch regularly with him, and we would go through the organized crime files. I wrote an article saying he was corrupt, the sheriff. He was selling badges. So he got a hold of me and said, well, you know, yeah, I'm corrupt, but I'm the least corrupt. Let's take a look at who's really got the juice around here and who's really got power and influence. So, you know, you looked at this, it was a cemetery. He got out of the car and ran and was chased down, according to police reports, and shot dead. And there was a huge battle. Since it wasn't in the city, it was in this cemetery that was part of the county. But it didn't look like they were looking real closely. And as you probably know, the Shapiro murder file was actually destroyed by the Columbus police chief, James Jackson, and he was suspended for destroying it. He claimed he destroyed it because it was libelous and would bring down the stock market. The reality is, you know, it's factual and truthful, and was, you know, condemning a very powerful man with allegations of organized crime connections. So that's the reason it really was destroyed.
Now that brings us to this late State of Ohio Inspector General David Sturtz, who was one of your sources in these stories. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about him and his sort of take on the Shapiro murder and related issues of bribery and public corruption.
Well, it was interesting. The Shapiro's killed in 85. Grand juries are convened. Nothing really comes out, but what also begins to happen in this period in the late 80s, early 90s, is Wexner begins to buy up massive amounts of properties through front organizations in an area called New Albany. And later it turns out, and you'll see it in Shapiro murder file, he's accused by the Columbus Dispatch, the daily newspaper, of bribing the president of Columbus City Council, Jerry Hammond. In fact, if I look out my window here in Columbus, there's a massive building known as the Jerry Hammond Building within a block of where we're talking. So, but Jerry Hammond, Mr. Wexner had lined up 10 investors at $25,000 each. Now, what the surprising part of all this was this $250,000 opened up a jazz club called the Major Chord, a jazz club which was owned by Jerry Hammond. All of this later came out, and Hammond resigned from city council. But what did Wexner get out of it? $500 million in water and sewage. He didn't, you know, a lot of very rich people were going to live in New Albany. It'd be much better if very poor and urban people in Columbus built his water and sewage for this Stepford, you know, rich enclave. So $500 million was spent of Columbus taxpayers' money to build water and sewer lines for Les Wexner so he could make a fortune off development. He was moving out of clothing, wasn't quite as interested, and he was moving into property development. And this hadn't been done since the 1950s. Columbus had not extended new water and sewage lines to any suburb unless they had a pre-existing agreement, because Mayor Sensenbrenner back in the 50s asked the key question, why should people that are much poorer in an urban area subsidize the suburban rich? But that's what happened with New Albany in the late 80s. And again, all of this coming to a head. This is when I'm spending some time with Earl Smith, 91, 92, 93. He loses in 92 election, but he's got all these files. And he's essentially arguing that a lot of people are in Wexner's pocket. Wexner didn't get indicted himself in part. It's a miraculous story. Mr. Wexner didn't know he was setting up Hammond in a for-profit enterprise. He thought the money he lined up was going to help poor black children in the inner city at the Martin Luther King Center. And a guy who vouched for him, Michael Coleman, obscure attorney who worked for Schottenstein, Zox, and Dunn, in 1991, I know because I had been approached about a seat as well, was appointed to city council. And then later, because of the backing of Mr. Wexner, went on to be the three-term mayor of the city and the first black mayor in Columbus. And he's doing very well to this day. So people who played ball with Les Wexner did quite well.
Whereas, I was going to add, whereas Arthur Shapiro, who I guess was scheduled, he was being investigated by the IRS.
Yeah, the next day he was supposed to be meeting with the feds, the IRS.
And then he got murdered.
Yes.
So going from there, you have all of this Shapiro stuff happening, the New Albany stuff. I asked you about this State of Ohio Inspector General, David Sturtz. And I know he's been of interest to a lot of people when it comes to looking at Epstein and Wexner. Who is David Sturtz?
Well, David Sturtz was kind of a Boy Scout. He was the ethics trainer for the State Highway Patrol, you know, considered incorruptible, you know, sort of the kind of guy you couldn't bribe. And they made him the State Inspector General under George Voinovich, who was elected in 1991 as governor of the state. So, and then he began to do his job real well. He was looking into Mr. Lindner of Chiquita Bananas and was asking about the story in the Cincinnati Inquirer about the Chiquita Bananas and United Fruit being involved in drug smuggling into the United States. He should have probably started with the CIA and asked them, but in that scenario, he was looking there. And then when the stuff came up with Jerry Hammond and the bribery, the role of the State Inspector General is to root out public corruption. And he had subpoena power. So he began to go heavily after Les Wexner and friends of Les Wexner, which is what got him fired as the State Inspector General. But one of his last acts, was to literally, he's dead now, so I had an agreement with him, was to leak me the Shapiro file. He arranged for that to be leaked to me unredacted. And so if you read it today and it's on the internet, that's because of David Sturtz, who was fired and later turned up as assistant safety director in Columbus, going after the police chief and other corrupt individuals, including a good friend of Mr. Wexner's, Tommy Banks, who was in all sorts of business deals as a black minority partner. And again, I know Mr. Banks, I know very well. His attorney, Richie Hollenbaugh, called me up one time and said, "My client's out with a gun looking for you." He was obligated as an attorney. I called up Sheriff Earl Smith, who knew Chief Jackson, who called up the police chief who hated me, and the police chief had him picked up. And what Smith told me is the police chief told him, if you shoot the trachis, people actually believe everything he writes.
Marlon, I think you had something you wanted to add or ask.
A bunch of things. I guess it leads into to Voinovich. You mentioned when in your article about SAT that it seemed like it was the Department of Development in Ohio who was really pushing for it. I was wondering if that relationship started around the same time, but that relationship between Wexner and the Department of Development started back with this New Albany project. And what was that relationship, you know?
Well, it was, under the Voinovich administration, I would argue, George is now dead, but I wrote a book called, it's an anthology of my investigative reporting called The Brothers of Voinovich. Voinovich was corrupt in the sense that he allowed corruption to flourish throughout his administration, particularly his chief of staff, Paul Mifsud, who had literally had ties to George Bush and the CIA. And of course, his brother, Pauly Voinovich, who is always, off doing some petty scam somewhere in the state. So Voinovich had become the mayor of Columbus when Mayor Dennis Kucinich, the young boy mayor, wouldn't give in to the bankers and sell off the municipal electric power department. So they, called a strike on Cleveland, ran him out and brought in this banker, George Voinovich, who had long ties to organized crime. Well established, and was nearly indicted while the governor, then later went and became a senator. So the Voinovich administration was massively corrupt. There was the pie insurance scandal, where the largest insurer in the state did most of the medical malpractice, went under through bribery, making sure their books wouldn't be investigated. Voinovich, through a company known as the V Group, was the leading his family business, changed its name to V Group, and used Tommy Banks, who was connected to Les Wexner, to build prisons and jails all over Ohio, while the governor was cracking down on crime, cutting the higher education budget, and tripling the budget for prisons and jails in Ohio.
This actually brings me around to, there's an Iran-Contra connection to all of this. You cover it in the article.
Absolutely, yes.
You cover it in the article Spook Air. Maybe you could summarize what that connection is to my listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Well, again, Iran-Contra, tremendous controversy during the Reagan and spilling over into Vice President Bush's administration. Iran, part of it was we illegally, well, we being the Reagan administration, illegally gave, sold, traded, simultaneously released for hostages, arms to Iran. The arms itself, the money they got for that, was then illegally given to the Contras, which was really the former corrupt National Guard by Somoza, the corrupt dictator in Nicaragua. So you had a situation where the U.S. is giving weapons, allowing weapons stolen from our arsenal, run out of the White House by a man named Ali North. We're giving weapons to who we called Murder, Inc., the Ayatollah Khomeini. And in exchange for that, the money was being secretly used to fund a group of fascist thugs in Nicaragua who turned out to be more interested in running cocaine into the U.S. Than they were fighting, you know, the Sandinistas who were leftists. So that airline, which became known when its cargo kicker, Eugene Hassenfuss, got shot down in it. And it turned out the papers on board found by the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the leftist government people, turned out to show it was Air America, the legendary heroin opium air that was used for covert operations out of Long Chin in Laos during the Vietnam War. So first Air America selling drugs to, you know, our soldiers, our boys, so to speak, in Vietnam, the Philippines, and Thailand. Then it comes back. It sold off as Southern Air Transport. It's still a proprietary. It still appears to be controlled by the CIA. And when the scandal broke in the 1980s with Iran-Contra, we're given the Ayatollah Khomeini, who we supposedly hate, these arms, and it's going down to these drug dealers, then it had to move. Where did it come? And who arranged it? Les Wexner and Jeff Epstein. It came to Columbus, Ohio, with at least $25 million of taxpayers' money funding it.
And this is for people that don't know, I would suggest reading, you know, maybe Gary Webb's Dark Alliance for more on that drug connection. I mean, at absolute best, it seems as if the CIA was looking the other way when it came to people using these planes for drug trafficking purposes.
Right, as they're rumored to have said, we're not looking for good citizenship. you know, I mean, they provided the transportation. But the Southern Air Transport, as you'll see in the papers I unearthed in Spook Air, in that article, Wexner was supposed to be the beneficiary and the limited for using these Hercules, these huge cargo planes, to come into Rickenbacker, former full-time military base, but still with military connections right outside Columbus. And his logistic man at the time was that would help him move his money and come up with deals and what he needed, Jeff Epstein.
Now was Epstein particularly involved in that because they were based in Miami? Before, was there any connection there? Was it because Epstein had business contacts in Miami that he was able to handle that?
Business, yeah, he did have business contacts in Miami, and he was supposed to be the guru for all the international movements of money. And he really was described at the time, if you look at the documents, as the guy in charge of logistics and money for Wexner.
And was that any sort of formal position, or was it just sort of like a catch-all term for what he did? Did he ever have a formal position at the Limited?
Well, he had a formal position. You know, he owned an estimated 10% of New Albany after the fact. So, but again, he was the money man. His real power was through the power of attorney, which was signed in 1991. And when I looked at the county records office wasn't really revoked to 1999. So he had absolute durable power of attorney to move Wexner's money, to sell Wexner's property, to buy things for Wexner anywhere on earth through this power of attorney, this POA. signed in Columbus, Ohio.
I guess that leads to the next question of what leads Wexner to giving Epstein so much power? Why give him this power of attorney? Why, like, they're very close in a way that almost seems, yeah, it's strange in some ways, it feels like.
Yeah, well, you know, it was thought to be, you know, the notion of a bromance, whether it was physical or not, nobody knows because we weren't there watching. This state inspector general's office in Sturtz, you know, called Epstein the boyfriend. But it was clear that, you know, well, he was much more than that. He made himself indispensable, right? Well, what do you need? Is there a dirty deed or is there something ruthless that you need to do? And Wexner's a bit too kind. Then you had Jeff Epstein did it. You know, he was, and he brought really, Wexner, you know, hiding in a closet somewhere, you know, being real low key. Suddenly, you know, you're hanging out, you're bringing out the models from Victoria's Secrets and Bendel's and the other places that he owns with textile. So now you're having big charity events with incredibly beautiful people. And Epstein's your guy. Epstein's arranged everything. And you can trust him. But later on, I mean, the same question was asked by Sturtz and by Earl Smith. And at a certain point, both of them were looking as to whether Wexner was being blackmailed, particularly after the PLA was signed. I mean, which made sense to nobody. I mean, you can have somebody handle your money without giving them a durable power of attorney. So both of them were like, we're under the suspicion that Epstein was running a honey trap, right? He was getting powerful people or perhaps Les Wexner to compromise himself sexually, and it was being filmed or videoed or pictures were being taken. So they actually were looking at that as a possible theory.
And I believe, too, that Epstein had his own home on King George Drive in New Albany from 1994 until December 2007. And one of the things you note is that Wexner in 1998 transferred his interest in their Manhattan property for $20 million to Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the house in New York that was written about in Architectural Digest. It's sort of a high-tech James Bond house with video cameras everywhere. Actually, Epstein did much better. At one point, Mr. Wexner gave him the guest house, the second most valuable house in Franklin County, along with 30 acres of land out at New Albany. The house originally designed for his co-developer, Jack Kessler, who kind of took the fall in the Shapiro killing. You know, he wasn't really charged with it, but took kind of, you know, covering up minor charges that discredited him. So, Epstein owned property in New Albany, you know, houses that were probably beneath him. But again, he was given the guest house and 30 acres there for a period of time, which most people thought that Abigail was trying to do stuff to get Jeff out of there. I know a lot of people that, you know, have been around Jeff socially, but he scared the hell out of a lot of people. I remember when I was writing about him at Columbus Live, my publisher, you know, was, you know, like, Jeff Epstein, scary. Who knows who he's connected to? Who knows? You know, he could be, you know, connected to the intelligence community. He's a real scary guy.
CIA, but, Mossad, who knows, right?
MI6, sure. And he fostered that, you know. I think Mr. Saylor in 92 wrote about that in an article early on. And Nigel Rosser, before they scrubbed his article at the Evening Standard, because I wrote an article called Wexner's Royal Connections. And I got that information from Nigel Rosser. And his article later disappeared. But he was clearly passing information on to me about Prince Andrew, right? It's, you know, Prince Andrew has been on 9 holidays and Mr. With Ghislaine Maxwell, and Mr. Epstein has been on 5 with them. So they were, I think they were trying to send a message, and I was the messenger back in 2003. That's also when I found out about, you know, Wexner Foundation.
I wanted to ask about that, the Iraq War connection, which I did not know about until I came across your work.
All right. Well, the again, it's somebody, you know, I mean, I had good sources, and somebody was appalled by it, leaked it to me from Mr. Wexner's foundation. Hopefully they won't go looking for him at this point. But yeah, the they had done the essentially polling and propaganda lines on how to sell what I believe was the illegal war in Iraq. You know, how do you attack a country that, you know, still hasn't recovered from the Gulf War, and despite its flaws, at least it was sanctioned by the UN. I mean, how do you wage aggressive illegal war against Iraq? Well, you know, if you want to find out, go to the Wexner Foundation, and they hired Frank Lutz, the famous Republican pollster, and they just said, you know, used the term Saddam, repeated often, throwing his 2 sons, and you can kill, you know, more than 100,000 people.
And Epstein is directly involved in all of that as well.
Well, he's, you know, very close advisor to you know, Mr. Wexner at the time. And Mr. Wexner, you know, was highly honored in the 60th anniversary. Wexner was good friends with Max Fisher. Max Fisher School of Business, one of the founders with Wexner of Mega.
The Mega Group.
Yes, that does, you know, works on behalf of Israeli foreign policy. But Max Fisher in Detroit, my uncle George Hasoulis claims he used to work for Fisher when he was a bootlegger. Mr. Fisher was wise enough to buy up oil and gas companies in Findlay, Ohio, and later have an interest in Marathon Oil. And then he set up a refinery in Windsor, Ontario. They say that it wasn't gas and oil in his gas and oil trucks. It was some of the best Canadian club whiskey in the world. And later he went on from there to do favors for the CIA and ended up on the board of United Fruit when United Fruit was involved in the coup in Guatemala, the Arbenz coup in 1954. Or otherwise known as the United Fruit Coup, right? When Arbenz was going to nationalize the food and won that election before he got a chance to draw up the check and take over the food supply in Guatemala, he was killed. Well, he wasn't killed, but he was run out.
And Fisher was considered Wexner's protege, otherwise his mentor. Is that right?
Mentor, absolutely, right? It's the first real, you know, kind of Jewish billionaire to hook up with the Republican Party. He did a backdoor diplomacy, actually, in the Ford administration. Jerry Ford, my congressman, later our only appointed president. Fisher was very well connected. Max Fisher School of Business is right here at Ohio State. But if you really want to know how Max Fisher did business, what you do is you get $100 million worth of land from the city council in Detroit for $1. And then you arrange to get the UDAG, the urban development grants, that are supposed to be for light rail or subways heading out to the suburbs. And you use it to run essentially rail L trains from the Riverfront West luxury apartment, which he got the land for $1, to the Renaissance Center, over to Greektown, and now the casinos. So you can live in Detroit, be incredibly rich and white, and never actually set foot in the city. just take the little train from the Riverfront West luxury apartment to the Renaissance Center built by Hank the Deuce, Henry Ford II, now the headquarters for General Motors, and then head over to the restaurant business area, which is now kind of the sports area and casino area. And that was the, and you get a, my favorite part, a 24-year, 50% tax abatement for anyone who buys that building. They said it was because they were providing jobs for Detroit. I actually did a study when I was in graduate school at Wayne State. 12 jobs were being created, primarily some maids and doormen and a few armed guards that were protecting the people riding the L train that just went around in a little loop so no one could head out to the suburbs and actually get a job.
Now, bringing this all around, with regards to the bigger picture, I mean, we're talking about organized crime, we're talking about intelligence agencies, sexual blackmail. I know I don't want to speculate too much, but what would you say are the areas that people wanting to understand this connection between Les Wexner of L Brands and Victoria's Secrets and Jeffrey Epstein, where should they go if they're really trying to understand it? Where does the picture lead us to?
Well, I think you want to look at, I mean, where did the Lolita Express come from, the 727, for example? And I'm sure you know the answer, which is it came from the Limited. That was a former Limited plane. So, you know, these islands moving money, money laundering, I think ultimately you might want to, I know the feds were looking at it, and we're going to ask Mr. Shapiro about it. You know, how much money does Mr. Wexner have, and where does it all come from? So there's a variety of things you need to look at, and who are they tied to politically, right? With Epstein, right? I mean, Bill Richardson, you want to look at former New Mexico governor. Bill Clinton was on the Lolita Express and on, you know, Pedo Island or Orgy Island, as it was also called. So you might want to look, you know, Prince Andrew.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yeah, and might want to look into the charges by the 13-year-old girl in her criminal complaint. But, yeah, I mean, you've got a variety of people who normally would not be hanging out with, you know, a shady character like Jeff Epstein. So, and again, how important would it be to have information on, you know, two presidents, particularly if you had the ability to blackmail? Now, you don't really need to go and say, hi, I got pictures of you. All you got to do is, you know, sort of let it be known quietly, and you don't really have to bribe them or coerce them. They know what they need to do. Of course, that could mean killing you when you get arrested as well.
Now, in regards to Les Wexner, I want to ask something real quick, Marlon, and then I'll
go first.
Let you sort of take over for a bit. I wanted to ask, so Les Wexner has sort of been able to fly under the radar in a lot of ways with regards to the Epstein case. He has said, oh, I didn't know, and blah, 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 blah. He's always had his little alibis. Why do you think the case is worth pursuing? Why should we not trust Wexner's, oh, I'm, you know, an innocent man type spiel?
Maria Farmer, I mean, he said he didn't know, but he, I mean, Maria Farmer in 96 was out at the guest house on the compound in New Albany when she made the allegations of sexual assault against her by Guilin and Jeffrey. She was working there, you know, as an artist, had been solicited by Epstein. And I don't believe for a minute that Epstein wasn't told by the New Albany police or his, you know, infamous security forces with their infamous dogs, who I've run across on occasion, that he didn't know. He, you know, had to know at least by 96. Was he as ignorant, or, you know, was he being blackmailed? I don't know, but it was his money that enabled Jeff Epstein. Epstein did not have or ever make that kind of money other than moving a large amount of Wexner's money around the world. So Wexner is the enabler. I mean, but he flies below the radar because it's like Al Capone's soup kitchen. They loved Al Capone during the Great Depression, right? He fed the hungry. So when you make massive donations to the Ohio State University and dozens of buildings all over town are, you know, named after you, you know, Columbus Monthly, which ought to be ashamed, the, you know, monthly magazine in Columbus was kind of like, oh, poor Les Wexner. We still love him. Yeah. Okay, well, take a look at the Shapiro file. Take a look at the Southern Air Transport. Take a look at Maria Farmer and that institute. All of that was enabling Jeffrey Epstein.
And I was just going to add in that regard, really briefly, and then I want to kick it over to Marlon. Are there any elements of organized crime in the Ohio area that we can sort of specifically tie Wexner to, like any families or any elements that we take a look at?
Genovese LaRocca, you know, is one of the original New York and Pittsburgh, but the Shapiro report said the number one suspect was Eddie DiBartolo Jr. out of Youngstown, Ohio, former owner of the San Francisco 49ers, who now seems to be taking over down in Tampa, in the Tampa area. But yeah, Eddie DiBartolo Jr., who, you know, got in trouble for bribing the former governor of Louisiana for a riverboat license and had to give up his interest in the 49ers. But yeah, that would probably be the most prominent.
Marlon, I want to kick it over to you. You've been following the Epstein story, you know, with me for a while now and looking at the Jean-Luc Brunel aspect of it. And I want to give you a chance to ask Dr. Fitrakis any questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to know a little more, Bob, about what it was like in Columbus at the time you're doing all this reporting. You said there was a social scene around Epstein that sort of protected him, or around Wexner too. I was wondering, who were the people in Columbus at that time? You know, who were the movers and shakers?
Well, the real power in the city was the Wolf family, who fortunately for Wexner also was thought to have links to organized crime. They were rumored that, in fact, their patriarch either was pushed or fell off the Dispatch publishing building, but he actually had come out of the old Ohio pen. Where he learned to make shoes. Wolf Brothers wear you well shoes. And from that, they were smart enough, and they were alleged to be handling vice in the south of the city here in Columbus. They were smart enough to buy up the newspaper and then later radio stations, two radio stations, WBNS, Wolf Brothers News and Shoes. So they were the real movers and shakers, and Wexner was the newcomer. Now, the Wolf family pretty much has aged out, and their kids, they've sold off, you know, a large part of their empire, including the daily newspaper, as newsprint isn't quite what it used to be. It isn't worth as much. Again, they, in most cases, they covered up for Wexner, but they didn't when it came to the bribery of Jerry Hammond and Wexner's involvement in the Major Chord Jazz Club investment in exchange for the $500 million in water and sewage infrastructure. So they had power. Wexner, of course, kind of took over the local Democrats. You know, the Wolf family was more Republican. They took over the He gave money even though he was with the Republican Party at the state level and the national level up until Trump. But he found a lot of corporate Dems that liked his massive donations.
And then speaking of Trump, was Trump friends with Wexner? Because I found a magazine article from 1990 that says Donald Trump was at his house, you know, hanging out. Did you ever see that in Columbus?
No, I mean, it was Wexner, you know, kind of entertained all the powerful people. So there was notions that they had met. It was much clearer that Epstein was, friends with Donald. But what happened a lot of times, be it Schwarzenegger or someone like Donald Trump, Wexner, and really a lot of this was facilitated by the appearance of Epstein, would have these massive fundraisers out at his mansion complex. And so it wouldn't be surprised me if that's where Trump was, because anyone of note that you could have out to make a donation or to draw people in for a fundraiser, that was the type of operation. And now in retrospect, I'm wondering if it's because Epstein was trying to blackmail him offer him up some, you know, sexual tidbits.
Right. I was going to ask in that regard, is Wexner a sort of victim of Epstein in his own strange way, or is Wexner more complicit in all of this?
Well, he's the original enabler. Now, the question, I know Wexner sent lawyers and financial people down to one of the Jane Doe lawsuits in Florida. I talked to the attorneys down there, and they were looking for missing money. Where Wexner had the money. And what I learned from one of the attorneys is Wexner said, "I'm a victim," right? He stole, untold millions from me and my family. So Wexner's, and I have no doubt Jeffrey was skimming, but, you know, of course he was gonna, but he also seemed to have made Wexner a lot of money. Wexner's wealth actually went up when Epstein was doing God knows what, with his investments. So, yeah, the broader question is, are we ever gonna know? I think he knew with Maria Farmer. I think he was well aware. I think Abigail kind of pushed Epstein, away, and they sent him in different directions because they knew he had certain problems. But we're never going to know with Wexner. He does not appear to be forthcoming. I think he's mainly just trying to save his reputation. Wexner should be thoroughly investigated. And I don't think that will happen with Donald Trump being the president and being compromised because of his friendship and relation with Epstein.
Marlon, is there anything you want to ask in closing, and then we'll wrap up?
I guess in closing, I'd like to sort of ask if you think that, Wexner is making efforts now, like active efforts, you said, to preserve his reputation. Do you know if he has private investigators out there sort of intimidating people?
I think Mr. Wexner has always had private investigators.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff Epstein the international man of mystery would bring in, And I think both of them have ties to the intelligence community. They're not agents, the CIA, but I think they're both connected. I think when Acosta said that, why did Epstein get an easy sentence? And he said, I was told he was an intelligence guy, had intelligence connections. I think that's the case. I think they shared incredibly valuable information on the sexual practices of powerful people. that Epstein knew. And in exchange for that, you know, they looked the other way at Epstein's pedophilia. I think it is exactly what it looks like. It was a honey track. It was a sexual blackmail. And who knows, ultimately, whether or not Wexner himself ended up being, you know, a victim of the blackmail, you know, something he said or did, or just kind of being associated with Jeff Epstein.
Two more questions really quick, and then I'll let you go. I know we've kept you close to an hour now. I guess the first is, there is going to be someone listening to this who will respond by saying, oh, he's saying intelligence agencies, and he's just implying that, you know, the Mossad is behind everything. There have been a lot of people that have tried to dismiss the whole Jeffrey Epstein case.
But now I'm thinking the CIA is Southern Air Transport. I mean, that's the CIA, MI6. Could be other agencies. You know, the Mossad would make sense. I mean, both Epstein and Wexner's, you know, were supporters of Israel. At one point, Mr. Wexner was the single largest private contributor to Israel.
Right. I was just noting, I don't think you're saying, oh, the Mossad is just behind everything. I think you're actually very reserved.
I don't think they're agents, you know. I think this Mossad is smart enough to be behind a few things. And I think you don't have to be a member of the Mossad or the CIA or MI6 to realize if you've got film, video, of very powerful men committing pedophilia with children, that could be of tremendous value in terms of getting them to do what you want them to do. And I don't think you need to be an intelligence agent to figure that out. People blackmail on various levels all the time, from within families to local cities. This just happens to be at a high level.
Last question here. We've been building up to it. What is your take on the arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell? Do you think this is going to have ramifications? I know you don't like to speculate. You're a very hard-nosed journalist. You're very honest and sort of, you don't speculate nearly as much as some people have speculated about this case. I appreciate that. But what do you think of Ghislaine Maxwell's arrest?
Well, it depends. Does she actually have what she says she has, or what rumors report? Does she have something stashed? I mean, that if she was smart, she would have, you know, video, digital, powerful people. Maybe wherever she stashed it, and it depends on how smart and clever she is. But again, just like with Jeff Epstein, she's like the Mayflower Madam. Knowing that much usually gets you killed. But they usually don't kill you till they make sure that your evidence doesn't come out.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you, Dr. Robert Bob Fitrakis, for coming on Parallax Views. I really want to say that I appreciate the work you've done on the Epstein case. And I have to add, I wish you were in more of the Netflix Epstein documentary.
Well, they cut a lot of it out. There was other documentaries as well. But I'll tell you one story. I was out there in the car, and two detectives showed up from New Albany, a squad car with two uniformed police and an SUV with another uniformed police. And they told me that the two roads had been closed, the bridges, which were these little tiny bridges that weren't really bridges, and I shouldn't have been by the guard post there at the compound. And I responded by saying, well, you're letting people go in to the New Albany Country Club. I was just going there to see if I could become a member. Of course, they realized I didn't have a knapsack with a couple $100,000 in my pocket to pay the membership down payment. But I met the police there, which doesn't surprise me.
So how can my listeners keep up with the work you're doing now, and how can they just follow what you've been writing?
Well, my site is freepress.org. And I do a lot of stuff there. I've done a lot of stuff and with elections as well, with one assumption. Why would you allow private for-profit proprietary entities to secretly write your source code to count votes? I mean, unless you want elections stolen, you know, you would start with open source and transparency. So freepress.org, and again, I would. There's a lot of stuff that I wrote that I forgot I wrote. But, you know, if you Google Fitrakis and Epstein, or do a search online, or Fitrakis and Wexner, I think you'll find some interesting stuff, as clearly both of you had. And, you know, I appreciate when I wrote this stuff back in 97, 98, I thought I was going to, you know, win some awards and go on to be famous. I didn't know, you know, it would take 30 years.
Well, thank you again, Bob Fitrakis, for coming on Parallax Views.
All right. Glad to be
thank
here,
you, Bob.
Good being with you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Bob Fitrakis, examining the Leslie Wexner connection to the sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein. Many thanks to Bob for his years of hard work and for coming on the show. Also, a shout out to Marlon Ettinger for helping me co-host this edition of the program. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. It is you, the listeners like Amelia, Martin, Mark, Gary, and Brace, who make this show possible. So if you can, join those aforementioned folks in supporting me at the $10 tier. You'll get a producer's credit on each episode. And if you can't do that, there's always the $5 tier, or you can always just throw me a dollar on the $1 tier. I would really appreciate it, and it allows me to keep this show going. So, once again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. Throw me some cash if you can. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.